I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. When did porn become sex ed? Conversations between adults and teenagers about what happens after yes became rare. This appeared in the New York Times in mid-March, and the author, Peggy Orenstein, is our guest this hour for a much-needed conversation. We do want to tell you that today's conversation is about teenage sexuality, and we may be somewhat explicit in what we say this hour. Obviously, her article in her book indicates there is a need for that, but the conversation may not be appropriate for young children. Peggy begins her article by talking about an email from a 21-year-old college senior, and it was about how ill-equipped she was to talk about sex. The abstinence-only curriculum in her middle and high schools, which Peggy says is a big waste of $2 billion, taught her little more than don't. Her parents would have been willing to answer any questions, but the topic made them more uncomfortable than it made her, so she turned to pornography, saying to Peggy, there's a lot of problems with porn, but it's kind of nice to be able to use it to gain some knowledge of sex. She talks in this article about high schools and middle schools and how they are woefully lacking when it comes to sex education. She talks about women and when do we address the exploration, self-knowledge part of that when we look at sexuality and girls. She talks about the latest survey on American sexual behavior that was published in 2010, and it looks at a number of issues, at masturbation, at anal sex, at oral sex. It looks at the rising role of certain kinds of sexual practices and college women using their partner's physical pleasure as the yardstick for their satisfaction. So there's a whole lot to talk about this hour of the program, and their subjects and pornography, subjects that we don't normally address. Parents find it hard, so we decided we'll talk about it on the radio. Peggy is the New York Times bestselling author of a number of books, most recently Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. She's also author of Cinderella Ate My Daughter, Waiting for Daisy, Flux, and Schoolgirls. She writes for many other publications, the LA Times, Vogue, Mother Jones, Slate, Oh, the Oprah Magazine, contributed commentaries to NPR's All Things Considered. She was born in Minnesota, Midwestern person, and has spent some summers in northern Wisconsin. Peggy, thank you so much for being with us. Hi.
Thank you. Yeah, we had a cabin on Madeline Island.
Did you really?
Uh-huh. Yeah, my grandparents are from Appleton.
Oh, how nice. What a nice place to have a cabin, Peggy.
Oh, it was wonderful.
Oh, I'll bet it was. Mm-hmm. I read this article, I read it in the New York Times when it appeared, and I thought, oh my gosh, how little I know about this, even though we have one millennial in the family, mm-hmm. and I have learned some things, let me tell you, from that millennial, that if we don't talk about these issues, it is so quiet. We don't know what's going on, do we?
No, you know, that's right. If we don't talk about these issues, the culture is going to do it for us.
Yes.
And when you talk about the pornography issue, that's a big change mm-hmm. in generationally, because since the rise of the Internet, kids have more access to more porn and more extreme porn at far younger ages. And there was a survey done in England of college students that found that 60% of kids consult porn in part for sex education, even though 75% of them said that they knew that it was about as realistic as pro wrestling.
Isn't that amazing? And is it they're consulting pornography because they don't have any place else to consult, or what is it?
Pretty much. I mean, I think that's true, yeah. And, you know, it's not where you want your kids to be learning sex. It's not.
No.
It's for one thing, it's there for male gratification, for, you know, it's the occasional feminist porn site aside, it's there, you know, it eroticizes humiliation, it shows unrealistic images of both women and men, and a very commodified form of sexuality, obviously. But yeah, I mean, you know, we in this country have this very strange schizophrenic attitude where on one hand, you know, the culture is littered with female body parts. Girls learn to play at sexy before they know what the word means. Sexualization is everywhere, but we never have real, honest, frank discussions about sexuality. So it's all this external image instead of something that kids, and particularly girls, learn to cultivate from within.
Mm-hmm. You cite this study, and it's a very interesting one, that looked at American teenage girls and Dutch teenage girls and how they're approaching their sexuality, what it is that Dutch mothers feel comfortable in talking to their daughters about, including when they first have intercourse and whether or not they had an orgasm, which is pretty amazing for moms to be able to discuss that freely, and what American moms are saying to their kids and what our culture is saying. And as a result, the statistics, when you look at pleasure you may receive from sexuality, when you look at not using birth control, getting STDs, or the things that can happen that can harm you as a result of not having the information, the difference, and also being having sex be a part of a loving, caring relationship mm-hmm. that we want for our kids, the differences are dramatic.
They are extreme. So the study compared American college girls and Dutch college girls, so very similar demographics, who were talking about their early sexual experience. And on every measure, the Dutch came out, you know, whether it was unwanted pregnancy, whether it was abortion, whether it was disease, you know, all the negative things, Dutch had far fewer, and all the positive things from knowing their partner very well, being in a loving, caring relationship, being able to talk to their partner, having more sexual pleasure, feeling in control of the encounter, feeling that they had better body images. Everything that we want, they also scored higher on. So it was just far and away, the Dutch girls' experience was everything we wanted, and the American girls' was pretty dubious. And the main difference, well, there were a couple differences. One was, again, that the teachers, doctors, and parents all talk to kids from a very early age about sexuality. But parents in particular, there was a really interesting difference, which was that while they were equally comfortable or perhaps uncomfortable talking about sex, American parents tended to focus on risk
yes.
and danger.
Mm-hmm.
And Dutch parents talked about how to balance responsibility and joy. And I'll tell you, as a parent myself, I have a almost 13-year-old daughter. That really affected me, because I think up until I started reading about that, I would have thought, okay, I'll talk to my daughter, or I've talked to my daughter about contraception, I've talked to her about disease protection, I've talked to her about consent, and my job is done. I've done a great job.
Right. Yeah. And you say in the article, and this is ever so true, we still tend to avoid the biggest taboo of all, women's capacity for an entitlement to sexual pleasure. We don't talk about it. So you've got girls that you've talked to for your book who really see the sexual experience as giving their male partner pleasure.
Absolutely. And, you know, I put it in a framework of, there's a psychologist at University of Michigan who talks about intimate justice. And just like, you know, who does the dishes or who does the laundry has sort of a political component in a household. Sex has those power dynamics too, and it's worth asking, you know, who is entitled to engage in sex? Who is entitled to enjoy the experience? Who's the primary beneficiary? How does each partner define good enough? And, you know, when you start looking at it that way and you start thinking about the way we talk to girls from the get-go about their bodies,
mm-hmm.
It's very dramatic. You know, when girls and boys are born, we tend to name boys' body parts. So, you know, at the very least, we say, there's your pee-pee something. But girls, it's like a void, and it just makes it unspeakable if you can't have a word for what's going on. And then they go into puberty education classes, and they learn boys have erections and ejaculations, and girls have periods and unwanted pregnancy, and they see the, you know, the diagram of the internal organs that graze out between the legs. And we never say vulva. We never say clitoris. Not surprisingly, fewer than half of teenage girls have ever masturbated. And then they go into their sexual experiences with a partner. And how could we possibly expect them to have some sense of their entitlement, of their agency, of their pleasure? And so not surprisingly, I found that, you know, more often than not, the girls thought of sexual encounters as really being about male pleasure, and
mm-hmm.
they measured their satisfaction by their partner's satisfaction.
So where does all of that come from historically in this country? Why is it so different in the Netherlands?
You know, there was a point in the 70s, in the 1970s, where at the point of the sexual revolution, when that started to happen, where the Dutch recognized that teen sexuality was a natural, normal part of development, and they wanted to foster it in the healthiest or the most supportive way possible. So they instituted a lot of really comprehensive sex education. They instituted refusal skills. When they found out that girls were still feeling, you know, more that sex was more about boys than them, they put in interaction skills. They do all these things to support their kids, whereas we kind of went the other way and got into a sort of harm reduction model and based everything on risk and danger, and then, you know, into abstinence, the abstinence-only era, where we might as well have, you know, set the $2 billion we spent on that on fire.
So the abstinence movement, you say, did absolutely nothing?
It did worse than nothing.
Really?
It did worse than nothing. Not only did it, and actually there's some really interesting maps right now on a site called Vox.com from the CDC, or you could get that at CDC, that show even now where kids are getting abstinence education primarily, where they're learning how to use birth control and look at disease rates and pregnancy rates. And you can see that in the places where kids are not getting any authentic sex education, the rates of disease and pregnancy are just far higher. And that's what happened, was it didn't really change when kids engaged in sexual behavior, but they were much less likely to contracept. The disease rates were way higher. And, you know, we haven't discussed this yet, but they also tended to engage in more oral sex and anal sex in order to preserve what they thought of as their virginity.
Hmm. And let's talk about oral sex and anal sex. This was, I didn't know this. I don't have these kinds of conversations with young people very often, but you write about oral sex being among the most significant transformations in American sexual behavior during the 20th century. In the 21st, the biggest change appears to be an increase in anal sex.
Mm-hmm. So let's start with oral sex, because one of the things that became very clear to me in doing the research for Girls and Sex was that we needed to broaden our definition as adults and parents talking to kids about sex beyond the idea that sex is intercourse or first intercourse, not because intercourse is no big deal, but because it's not the only big deal, and it makes everything else into not sex. And when it's not sex, it doesn't, it's not subject to the same ideas,
right,
about reciprocity, about respect, about coercion, about consent. So with oral sex, what I found was that it was very much one way with girls, you know, girls performing on boys. And so much of this was about ideas about female performance and female self-presentation, and, you know, all of it being outwardly directed instead of cultivated from within. And so girls, I got so sort of, I heard so many stories, I guess, of girls telling me this litany of, you know, one-way encounters, that I started saying, look, what if every time you were with a guy, he said, go get me a glass of water from the kitchen?
Right.
And, you know, he never got you a glass of water from the kitchen, or if he did, it was really begrudging. You'd never stand for it. And these girls that I interviewed, I should say, were college-bound or in college. They were bright. They were ambitious. They were driven. If I had interviewed them about their educational lives or their professional ambitions, I would have walked away impressed. So they were leaning in, but then in their personal lives, they were toppling. And when I would use the water example, you know, one of the girls just laughed and said, well, when you put it that way. And I thought, well, why wouldn't you put it that way?
Mm-hmm.
Why would you be less insulted by performing a sex act than going to get a glass of water repeatedly in the kitchen?
Mm. You also talk about this, which means that we really need to not only speak to young girls, we need to speak to boys here, perhaps just as much, that particularly with anal sex, many
yeah.
boys who pushed for fifth base is what it's called, approaching it less as a form of intimacy with a partner
yeah.
than a competition with other boys.
Absolutely. This was a broad study of 16 to 18-year-olds, and, you know, my first response was, geez, that's young. And when, again, you think that girls are going into these encounters, they have never masturbated, they've never had an orgasm on their own, they've never had an orgasm with their partner, and they're having anal sex. And that's, you know, at this very young age. And what they found was that it was boys who were pushing for it, that they saw it not as a form of intimacy with their partner, but as a way to sort of compete with other boys, that girls reported it as being painful, and that both boys and girls blamed the girls for that. saying that the girls were, the language they used was naive or flawed or unable to relax. And it's one of the areas we're seeing a large rise in behavior. And I think that that is, and not just I, but research shows that that's linked to the rise of visibility of porn.
Really? Interesting. Interesting. Let's welcome phone calls. Peggy Orenstein is our guest. You may have had a chance to see her article, When Did Porn Become Sex Ed? Conversations between adults and teenagers about what happens after yes remain rare. So we decided to have one of those conversations this hour of the show. She is also a very prolific writer, and the article in the New York Times based on this book and her conversations with teenage girls, many conversations, and looking at studies that have been done on American and other countries, sexual behavior among teenagers. Her book is Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Peggy Orenstein is our guest. We have a number of good phone calls, and let's go to Pam in Madison for our first call. Hi, Pam.
Hi. Thanks for this conversation. Of course, there's a direct line between this conversation and sexual crises on campus. In the U.S., we have made sex into a totally and singularly physical thing, even almost an animalistic thing, which leaves women in the position of often being live sex dolls. And it starts so early. If we could reframe it as sex as being under the headline of human relations, that this is how you be with someone else, it would give us a different starting point and a completely different conversation.
Very interesting. Peggy?
Yeah, I love that idea. You know, what I keep saying over and over is that we need to, we need to talk about sexuality as something that should be ethical, responsible, reciprocal, enjoyable. And in the last chapter of the book, I go into a sex education classroom where the kids are really working out all of these issues together, and they're having a dialogue, and they're learning exactly that this is another sort of place of citizenship in a way. And at one point, there's a boy who says, you know, I never thought about it before, but in that baseball metaphor that people use for sex, in baseball, there's winners and there's losers.
Mm-hmm.
So who's the loser supposed to be? And I caught the teacher's eye, and we both sort of, you know, nodded. And I thought, now there, you know, it was a small revelation, but I think it was a really important one. And I think that that boy will go into his encounters a better partner and less as an adversary.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the state of Pam. Thank you very much for your call. We're talking about some pretty some parts of sexuality that, you know, when I was young, we didn't even talk about because the practices weren't very well known, or, you know, you talked about the link between pornography and some of what young people are doing these days. It seems to me as though sex education needs to be pretty direct and pretty explicit these days. And I'm wondering, and you need to have males and females talking together about some of this. I'm wondering where this happens, how often it happens, if it happens.
I think it does in some pockets, you know. And one place that it happens actually quite beautifully is in the Unitarian Universalist Church.
Mm.
They have the Our Whole Lives curriculum, which goes from early childhood until, I think, into your mid-60s. Talking about human sexuality, and it's a marvelous curriculum, and that it's used in secular settings as well. And again, you know, what I did was I went into a sex education classroom where the kids really were talking about these things, and, you know, they talked about things like replacing the baseball metaphor with the pizza metaphor. You know, that's there's a sex educator named Al Vernacchio who talks about this. And it's such a wonderful metaphor, because when you think about pizza, there's no winners and losers in pizza, right? It's about sharing an experience with a friend, and you negotiate what's going to be on the pizza.
Oh.
And you know, maybe you like right. mushrooms and I like pepperoni, and so maybe we go halvesies, or maybe we do mushrooms this time and pepperoni next time. But we're all invested in the idea of a shared, pleasurable experience that's good for everybody. And, you know, if you keep insisting on pepperoni and I keep kosher, I'm not going to have pizza with you anymore.
Uh-huh. That's very, very interesting. A whole new picture in the mind.
It makes a real shift. So I think even, you know, for those of us who feel squeamish talking to our kids, something like that is something that just makes kids sort of go, oh, you know, it's a paradigm shift.
Mm-hmm. Carol in Madison, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Carol.
Hi. I'm glad that you mentioned the Al Vernacchio metaphor, because I've shown that to my daughter. It's listed under the TED Talks, and so if people wanted to look at that, it's a short little TED video. The reason that I'm calling is I have an 11th grader who is very interested in how sex ed is presented and reproductive health education is presented in the public school system, and she felt that her experience was less than satisfactory, and she's very interested in going into studying this when she goes on to college and maybe pursuing that sort of thing as a career. Mm-hmm. And so I was just calling to ask if you have any suggestions for a student who is very open to having those sorts of discussions with her, both her parents, fortunately, who's interested in studying that.
That's great. You know, I mean, it's. I think that there are. I can't really recommend any programs, but one place that is fantastic is Indiana University as a Kinsey Institute. And I did a lot of interviewing there for the book of the professors who work there, because they were engaged in so many different aspects of human sexuality and in thinking about these issues. So I don't actually know if it's more of an undergrad or a graduate school program, but that would be one place that is a great resource. And Planned Parenthood has really wonderful sex ed curricula for when they're allowed to go into schools.
Thank you, Carol, so much for your call. Pete in Wales, hi.
Hello, Kathleen. I'm a retired self-education teacher, and I can tell you and your audience that the curriculum for sex ed basically is either going away or being reduced dramatically in our public schools. I used to teach sex ed in a health education class at 6th and 7th grade level.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those classes are gone after I retired. And they have tried to, in our district, they have tried to put a small portion of sex ed into the Sci-Ed curriculum, and the people there are trying to do their best, but they do not have the background. Some people have a health education certificate, some do not. But before this was instituted, they had very little time, very little experience with sex education as an actual curriculum to teach. And they, because I talked to them, I still substitute, and they feel inadequate.
I'll bet. You have to know things. Pete, why did they cut the program so significantly? Do you know?
Well, it was a cost savings, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Peggy.
And
I'm sorry.
And obviously, when set up against other classes that needed to be taught, health education was very far down the
right.
list.
Yeah. Peggy, I'm sure that's not an unfamiliar story to you.
No, and in fact, only 23 states mandate sex education at all now, and only 13% mandate that education be medically accurate.
Ooh.
So, and the CDC found that, in a report that just came out a couple months ago, that fewer than half of the districts that do teach comprehensive sex ed meet their criteria for what should be in that curriculum. So we really aren't addressing this in our public schools in the way that I wish we would, the way that we should, the way that we could. And we are reaping, you know, the wages of that in behavior that is not ethical, you know, not respectful, that is distorted. And like I said, if we don't teach our kids, the culture is going to do it for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe things change. I was interested in some of the letters that were written to the editor after your New York Times piece, and there was one who I think was a principal of a school somewhere out east who said, the other thing that's been happening is very public displays, sort of like, I dare you to have sex on the school grounds somewhere. If you get a lot more of that going on, then you're going to have sex ed classes perhaps, huh?
Well, I don't know. You know, the thing is that in the American model, we keep thinking that the way to have a sex ed class is to tell kids don't. And that is not, that, you know, is, has been proven over and over again to be an ineffective way to teach kids, to just discourage it and say, don't do it, it's dangerous, it's harmful. But to actually talk to kids about these ideas of ethics, about intimate justice, about treating a person with respect, whether your relationship with them is going to last 10 minutes or 10 years, that kids actually respond to those more progressive and more explicit, frankly, conversations.
Right. Thank you very much, Pete, for your call. Let's go back to pornography for a moment. Mm-hmm. You, in your article, write about your daughter now in middle school. You were driving and passing a billboard. The giant letters read, "Porn kills love."
Yeah.
I haven't seen many of those billboards, but maybe there should be more of them. You asked your daughter if she knew what pornography was. She said, yes, Mom, but I've never seen it. You said, I know, honey, but you will.
Right.
And there are a few things that you need to do to know. Those of us who grew up in another era, we're not naive, but when we see what our children have been seeing on the Internet, sometimes you'll walk in on them and there's this pornography and you just go, oh, my gosh, what the heck is this? This is terrible. Sit down. We got to talk about this. What is it that we need to tell our children about pornography? What do we do about restricting access to pornography? How do you have that conversation with your daughter about how it gives a very different view about what sexuality is and how it can be lovely and wonderful and reciprocal instead of what she might be seeing,
right,
if she's
well,
looking at it?
And, you know, boys need this conversation very badly,
mm-hmm.
not just girls. But, you know, I think you have to start pretty earlier than you think you do. You know, I think kids are seeing, there's a study that showed that 40%, I think it was, of 10 to 17-year-olds have seen porn.
Ooh, wow.
Often not intentionally. So you can, you know, you can hit on it because a friend of mine's daughter Googled cute girls, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly she heard screaming from her room, you know, or some, you know, some older brother or sister goes, hey, look at this, and shows them their phone
with
something on it. So
right.
You have to get in there pretty darned early and say, like I just did, you know, I know you haven't seen it. That's okay. You're going to see it. And you need to know that it is about as realistic as pro wrestling. That just like when you see movies and you see violence in the movies and you know that that's not real and that's not what real violence is like, it's the same with this. This is not how people engage. And, you know, you start with that. And, you know, honestly, though, I had a hard time when I was writing going back and forth between the porn conversation and just the conversation about popular culture. Because it's not that different,
mm-hmm.
you know. I mean, those ideas have so permeated popular culture, and it's so hard to talk about without sounding like a fusty old prude.
Right, right.
But I'm not talking about it because I think sex is bad, or children, you know, or young people shouldn't be experimenting with, you know, sensuality and erotic tension, but because this commodified idea that constantly urges girls. You know, presents girls' bodies or women's bodies as the way they look to others being more important than the way they feel to themselves, and this disconnect between sexualized culture and an internally developed sense of sexuality, I don't think that is fusty or prudish. I think that's actually progressive, and that the ideas of pornography and the culture are the ones that are old-fashioned.
Let's go to Ellen in Madison. Hi, Ellen.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm also interested if Peggy has any recommendations. I remember reading a while ago about a gentleman who was doing some very progressive-sounding sex education classes, and I failed to save that article, but I'm wondering if, I mean, I'd really like to see some curriculum that incorporates not only the idea, the reality that our kids are going to be sexually active, but can we give them some healthy ideas about it, and as well as recognizing that it's not just heterosexual relationships right. that kids are having.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because it was really interesting to talk to lesbian and bisexual girls for the book. At one point, and one of the things about virginity that I talk about, the idea of virginity as first intercourse, is that it ignores the sexual experience of lesbian and bisexual girls who may not have ever had heterosexual intercourse. So at one point, I asked one of the girls, you know, when did you know that you weren't a virgin? And she said, you know, I had to Google that to try to figure that out. Google didn't have an answer for her, so she hemmed and she hawed, and she said, you know when I think I wasn't a virgin anymore? It was the first time I had an orgasm with a partner. And I thought, wow, imagine if just for 5 minutes that was included in your definition of virginity. You know, we completely changed.
Completely different. Yeah.
Yeah, it's completely different. But so in terms of resources, so as I said, I ended the book in the classroom of Charis Dennison, whose name is C-H-A-R-I-S. It looks like Charis Dennison. And she is a national consultant on sex ed curriculum. So she her website, you can just look her up, is one place. Al Vernacchio, I think, the guy that the pizza guy is who you read the article about, is my guess. He has a great book called For Goodness Sex, and that's a great way, a great resource for parents. Talk to Me First is another great resource for parents. For parents of young children, I really recommend the Roby Harris books, like they're called It's So Amazing, It's Not the Stork, It's Perfectly Normal. Those books are wonderful age-appropriate introductions for kids that start at age 4 and go through high school. So there's really stuff out there, but it's sort of scattered about.
Mm-hmm. And what about just for parents, to allow them to be obviously important sources of information? So parents, because a lot of parents, even if they're, as you start your article, are liberal, you feel like you can talk to your parents about anything, but a lot of people just don't feel darn comfortable in talking about any of this.
Right. And so if, you know, the resources I just cited can help with that.
Okay.
If they don't and you still feel uncomfortable, you know what you can do? You can enlist somebody else. I mean, I've been that person for friends where I have a girl who's, well, now she's an adult. Now she's 24. But when she was 16, her mom said she thought she was about to become sexually active, and so we went out for lunch, and I'll tell you, I'm no different than anybody else. I really wanted to fall through the floor, you know, rather than say these things.
Well.
But I made myself, you know, I thought, you walk your talk. And so I said, look, I know that you're thinking about first intercourse, and we talked about disease, we talked about protection, we talked about all those, you know, things that are, you know, consent, all those things that are very important. But I said, I want you to just think about some other questions, and you don't have to answer them if you don't want to, but just think about this. Have you ever masturbated? Have you had an orgasm on your own? Have you had an orgasm with your partner? Can you talk to him about what feels good and doesn't feel good to you? And if you say no to those questions, why are you rushing into intercourse? You know, who really is the more experienced, sexually experienced person? The person who has, you know, kissed for 3 hours and learned about sensuality and erotic tension and communication, or the person who gets wasted and rushes to unload their virginity as defined by first intercourse?
Yeah. More phone calls in a moment. Peggy Orenstein is our guest this hour, and we're talking about teenagers and sex, and we're talking about love and differences in culture and sexual practices that are prevalent right now, some because of the popularity of pornography. Peggy is a very prolific author. Her latest book is Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. She wrote a piece in the New York Times March 19th, that caught our attention. When did porn become sex ed? Conversations between adults and teenagers about what happens after yes remain rare. Our phone number is, and thank you, Ellen, for your call, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk@WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. John on Facebook, Peggy writes this. This is a great conversation. Thank you for having it. Listening at work, I've noticed that the conversation is mostly framed around male-female terms and sexuality. Most people are straight, of course, so it's understandable. But please don't forget, there are many kids who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, queer, questioning, etc., and they deserve a place in the conversation. They also deserve candid, accurate sexual education and information as well.
Absolutely, and that should also start young in our awareness with our kids that there are many different ways to be, whether you're talking about sexuality or gender identity or gender expression is important. As I said earlier, you know, I learned a lot from talking to the lesbian and bisexual girls that I talked to for the book, and I felt that also other girls who may be straight could learn a lot from them as well. One thing that research shows is that girls are more likely, young women, college-age women, are more likely than young men to define sexual satisfaction through their partner's pleasure. So they're more likely to say, if he had a good time, then I'm happy. And young men are more likely than young women to say, to define their satisfaction by their own pleasure. So they'll say, if I had an orgasm, then I'm happy. And that actually doesn't change when young women have same-sex partners. So they still are very invested in their partner's pleasure, and no surprise, the rates of orgasm in same-sex, not that that's the end-all and be-all, but it's an interesting measure, in same-sex encounters are way, way higher than in heterosexual encounters. And when I would talk to girls, they would say that they also felt that when they went off, you know, what they described as the script, you know, the sort of typical heterosexual script that they had learned about how sex is supposed to go, which often didn't have a lot to do with girls and their pleasure, that they were free to create their own idea of what a sexually satisfying experience would be. And thinking about that, I thought, boy, we could really learn something from that process.
Let's go to Jack in Wausau next. Hi, Jack.
Hi. I just want to once again kind of mirror this. Thank you for having this conversation. Very enlightening as a new father myself going into the realm of trying to teach my daughter what it is to, what sex is, you know, especially while I have these conversations with my wife and continuing on. But I wanted to go back to a comment you made at the beginning of the show that talks about the schizophrenic nature of the culture that we inhibit in the United States. And I want to mention and focus on the idea of religion. So raised Catholic, you know, there's this, and other Christian religions have this sort of schizophrenic nature inside themselves. They need to sort of engage couples that are wanting to get married, right, in sexual intercourse as a gift of God, you know, and of love to procreate, right? And that's kind of the base mission. But then that's really contrasted with the message that they're giving to young people, that they're giving to young couples that are not married, which, as we've seen over time, those are the people that are now engaging in this sort of sexual intercourse. And what you clearly pointed out are woefully inexperienced and unknowledgeable about their own bodies. And what are your thoughts about the religious component beyond the sort of utilitarian church example that you gave, which was really neat. Now I'm going to look into those resources myself. But what are your thoughts on that?
All right, Jack, thanks.
Well, I didn't, the kids that I interviewed, I couldn't really make a generalization based on their religious backgrounds, although they did span a broad range. But what I did do was talk about, I have a chapter that starts with a girl who went to Catholic school and a group of girls who are talking about what they learned about sex at school and how little they learned and how ignorant she was about her body and her belief when she was in high school that she would not just not engage in sexual intercourse before marriage, but really not do anything at all. And as part of that chapter, I also go to a purity ball, which is where daughters pledge to remain virgins until they're in a biblical marriage, and fathers pledge to support them in that. And what was interesting to me about it, I mean, it would have been really easy for me, given my beliefs and politics, to go to something like that and just slam it. But I did find one thing that really struck me, which was that even though I really didn't like the message, even though I know that that message, that abstinence pleasures, and abstinence-only education results in, you know, higher rates of pregnancy, higher rates of disease, more risky behavior in terms of oral and anal sex, even though I know all that, and I don't like what they were saying, the fathers were talking to the daughters, and it was the only group of fathers that I met that were having discussions about ethics, values, and citizenship around their sexual behavior. Again, I didn't like the message, but in the liberal communities that I went to, when I asked girls what they how they talked with their fathers about sex, they just laughed at me.
Mm-hmm. Fathers usually tell jokes, right? Didn't you say something
They said lame jokes. And the thing is that, and this was another thing that really struck me about the Dutch, in expecting kids to grow up talking frankly about sexuality in the family, they view it as a way to, one, exert a soft control on their kids. So at every step, there's more discussion, more values, more ethics, so they can teach the kids, positive interaction skills. But the other piece was that, particularly for girls, we force them to grow up by creating a rift with their parents so that they're presenting as, you know, good girls, so to speak, in the home,
mm-hmm.
and they're either lying or omitting what their behavior is like outside the home, and that creates a distance and a rift, and I don't want to have that with my daughter.
Mm-hmm. I don't think you will, Peggy.
Well, I hope not.
No, I don't think you will. Lois in Appleton, is it Lois? Hi.
Hi. This is kind of an interesting side with the pornography. In a recent issue of Time magazine, the front cover is porn and why young men who grew up with internet porn are becoming advocates for shutting it off. And the article is an interesting, I hadn't thought of it, but with regard to young boys, and it goes on to say about 9, he saw naked pictures on the internet, then he learned how to download the videos. And then at 15, he was streaming videos, and as with most people watching porn, they're masturbating. And in his case, when he was a senior in high school and had his first opportunity to be with a young woman, he was unable to function.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently it's a whole, not unusual that when this initial arousal doesn't do much for him, they go on to something that's more intense or more violent. And that when it comes actually time to be with another human being, the whole, it's just like their brain has learned something else. And the problem with the whole thing, they have a name for it. It's called porn-induced erectile dysfunction, PIED, which a medical term. And you don't really think of it as your boys will be boys and that they're going to, if they get the chance, but the idea that they could really, you know, cause themselves a lot of pain just
mm-hmm.
because they, when the time comes, they're not even able to, their idea of what it should be or what it would take to arouse them just isn't there.
Peggy.
Yeah, actually, there's an excerpt of my book in that package in Time magazine, if you look into it a little further, about the girl side. But yeah, you know, what I heard a lot of was that kids were taking, because they were looking at porn, because they were seeing that as a sort of educational tool, they were bringing those ideas into the bedroom as well. And girls felt a lot of anxiety about not measuring up physically to, you know, what they were seeing to the women in porn. They felt they should enjoy acts that they didn't particularly enjoy. And they also would say things to me like, my boyfriend wants to know why I don't make the noises that porn stars make when we have sex. And I got so kind of irritated with that, not with the girls, but with the fact that they had to ask that question of me, that my journalistic remove kind of dropped. And I was, you know, I started to say things like, look, it's a movie, and a movie has to have a soundtrack or it would be a silent movie.
Right.
You know,
right.
they have to make noise or it would be silent. You know, can't you figure that out? You know, and I just, as a person of a different generation, I just thought, what are you even talking about? You know, it just, so I think that this issue is, again, it's not about, you know, being prude or wanting to censor or anything like that, but it is having a demonstrably negative effect
yes.
on our kids' interactions.
Yeah. Thanks, Lois, very much for your call. Peter in Baraboo. Hi, Peter.
Thank you so much for taking the call. I want to honor the courage of moving this forward. I'm a school board member here in Baraboo, and I feel that it is imperative that these kinds of conversations become a part of our daily life in our schools. I'm also the father of four, separated by 25 years, and I have had the opportunity of listening to my eldest daughter talk to my two younger daughters, 14 and 11, about their sexuality and about how they approach it, and it's very similar to what your guest has been talking about. I believe that it probably is most important to get the one level older generation talking to the younger generation about their experiences, because the young women who have had some more experience and have gone through a period of questioning are the ones that these young people really can hear and listen to.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you so very much for the conversation, and let's keep going. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for the call, Peter. That's probably a good idea to have responsible older generation talking to a younger generation easier, right?
Fabulous. You know, one thing that Karis does in the final chapter of Girls and Sex is she has TAs in the classroom who are seniors in high school who, when she's working with the ninth graders, so that they have their seniors who they can talk to and go to who have been trained to deal with some of these issues. Peer education is fantastic.
Yes.
And also within a family, I mean, I tease my niece all the time, one of my nieces all the time, and say, I want you to play this role with Daisy, with my daughter. You know, I want you to be the one that she can go to, the one that she can talk to if she feels like she can't talk to me. So, again, you know, to build a team for your child
mm-hmm.
in a lot
mm-hmm.
of realms, but particularly in this realm where they have advisors and they have people they trust and they have people they can go to, you know, it can only be good.
You have to have somebody to talk to. As you indicate, many of the girls you talked with for your book just didn't have anybody to talk to, so they go to pornography. That's
exactly.
not good.
Exactly.
Yeah. Peter, thanks so much for your call. Maureen in Pleasant Prairie. Hi.
Yes, hi, Marina. This is a lovely conversation. I almost wish we could have this once every month. Here's the thing. I'm listening to the ages that are being mentioned. A few years back, because I'm an avid listener, the subject was brought up regarding an unusual revelation that was occurring in California, and their push to have elementary level sex ed, and that is because they had realized that more and more younger girls were going through puberty and subsequently coming up with unwanted and unexpected pregnancies. So though we're talking, you know, like everyone may be mentioning college age or high
right.
school age, the question is that just as we have the Barbies pushing where she looks beautiful and, you know, with the body image and
right.
all these other things.
Getting short on time. We're short on time.
Okay. Just give me your ideas and opinions regarding actually children at much younger ages.
Okay, and we've only got about 30 seconds, Peggy.
Well, I think we can start talking to kids very early on. I mean, you know, about body parts, naming correct names, about bodily integrity, about things that will eventually turn into conversations about consent and respect and mutuality and having a sense of your own agency. Absolutely, and the resources that I mentioned earlier will give you tools for that.
Yeah. Peggy, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Thank
my
you.
Pleasure.
Peggy Orenstein and her latest book is Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this program. Thanks to Lisa Nalbandian and Kendra Smith for doing on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. And thank you, everybody, for all of your calls and for listening. We'll put the New York Times piece on our website because it's obviously a conversation that needs to be continued and that it's good that we had here today. So thanks for having it with us. This is the Ideas Network.